That's what they say.
Hard work, work.
Hard work. I earn my pay.
Hard work, work.
Hard work. Do it every day.
Welcome to another Work Ethic Podcast. And I am excited about today's episode. I'm here with a director, producer, filmmaker, Andrea Nordgren, who I actually got a chance to meet when I was in Denver, actually at Eat Denver. She was shooting a little promo reel kind of thing, I guess you'd call it. And I got the opportunity to meet her there and be included in that project and have been kind of watching her since. And so I'm excited about your work. I'm excited to really dig into your relationship with work with you. But why don't I just toss you the ball for you to introduce yourself kind of properly to everyone, and we'll just kind of roll from there.
Sure, absolutely. You'd think people could introduce themselves well, but I always stumble with that because I have a very hybrid background and I've lived a long life, I feel.
Love
so
it.
I'm like, where do I start? And inevitably it goes back to like, I was a little kid and then this and then that.
Let's do it. We got time for that version. Let's do it.
Yeah, it becomes a long, I'll go with that version. And,
okay.
And if it's boring, you can edit it.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So I started out my life like in the arts and, you know, doing things like writing scripts and making my parents watch me perform, you know, plays and whatnot, doing the same thing with my classmates, writing, drawing, painting, you know, all of these ways of expression. And as I got into high school and then college, of course, I thought, I don't know what to do. You know, do you pursue an arts path, or do I make sure I can make a living? So
that's exactly, by the way, just a me too. So I was very good at drawing, very good at art, but, and my dad was also a voice going, you're really good at that, but what will make money? Because that's, yeah, exactly that though. So I'm with you here. Yeah. That's a real question.
Yeah, it was. And in going to college in the 80s, there wasn't a lot of like guidance, right, in terms of what to do. And I thought, well, here, I love these, you know, I love the arts, but I know I need to make a living. I also very much love helping people and understanding or trying to understand like people and why they do the things they do. So I just fashioned together a path. There was no graphic design degree at my college. They had an art degree. They had a dance degree, but
you
no
were a Hawkeye, right?
I was. Yeah.
Hawkeye,
yeah.
Okay.
Or I am. Not was.
I am. Yeah. That's where my dad and family were from there as well.
Oh, yep. Awesome. Yeah. Go Hawk. Loved Iowa, but yeah, just kind of lost, you know, like, what do I do? So I decided, like any overachiever, to get all the degrees and make sure I had them covered. I had a double major and then in psychology and communications, and then a minor in journalism. And I thought, well, hopefully that'll work. Hopefully that'll get me somewhere. So I started out as a graphic designer, and then I took a little path. After about 1 year in, I had an opportunity to go on this sort of, it's not a mission, but it was like a year of volunteer work. It was like the Peace Corps, but in the United States.
Like an AmeriCorps kind of thing?
Kind of. Yeah.
Okay.
It was a brand new program. It wasn't a religious program per se, like anyone could join and be a volunteer, but like some of the backing had to do with a church.
Where was it?
Well, I was supposed to go to Jamaica and build houses and schools and such. But about 3 weeks before I went, they said, we really could use you in New York because you have this like background. I worked at domestic violence shelters and such.
Yeah.
So they wanted me to go to New York and work in an inpatient drug and alcohol rehab. So I'm like 22 and thinking, okay, cool, I'll do that. So I ended up doing that. And I lived in New York for a year.
Nice.
Kind of like, you remember The Real World? Remember that show?
Yeah, I do actually.
It was The Real World before that. So I lived in a community with other people and basically like lived The Real World before it became a thing you could put on TV. Anyway.
I lived in a commune for a long time, and we actually had someone approach us about, can we just install a bunch of cameras and like, can this be, and I was like, that'd be awesome, but no way can this be aired, seen, absolutely not. No way. But yeah, definitely the Real World Association was there, right?
Yeah. Built in drama, right? Whenever you get human beings
so much fun
together. But it was a fantastic experience. I really enjoyed, I learned a lot, and I ended up then becoming certified as an alcohol and drug abuse counselor and working in Chicago for doing that for about 5 years. And then when I had my first son, I realized like, I'm going to reassess my life. Do I want to keep doing this or do I want to go back to, you know, design and the advertising world? And that's what I decided to do. I went back into that and then just have been working in that since forever, many decades, mostly as a creative director, but then most recently, probably the past 10 years, I've been doing producing, directing, both for commercial branded content and for films, so feature films. Yeah, so that brings me to today.
yeah, which you were saying you were just coming in from one project and on your way out for another or something like that. So we just kind of caught you in the little resting place here between the two.
Yeah, definitely. Production is not a quiet profession. There's always things, and I'm traveling a lot, so I've been doing some commercial work, and then I was just in Milwaukee shooting a music video.
So, did you say it was K-pop?
No, but 2 weeks ago I was working on some music videos for a kids group.
Okay.
Yeah, this week I did a music video for actually a friend of mine, jazz guitarist out of Chicago. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So then on to the next thing. Yeah.
Now you have a pretty, I'm just curious about the actual process that you guys have. So the company is called?
My company?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a production company called Heroin Films. I've had it for a while just as an LLC while I was employed, you know, to mm-hmm. do things that I wanted to do or to help companies that didn't have a huge marketing budget, et cetera. But then the past year I've been doing that full time. So that's my production company.
And you have others kind of on the crew?
No, actually.
That's your company. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just me. But we work as a collective, so I can pull in folks, whether it's production, you know, and I need to just crew up or I need to get a post-production partner or motion graphics, or if I'm working on a different type of project where I can bring creatives like writers and designers together. So it's kind of this collective.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, I was wondering about that as you're like shooting all these videos. I'm like, well, there's also a huge lift on the back end of that, right? And like actually editing those together. And are you kind of like do it all like but also hire in here and there as, because like you can't be everywhere, right? Getting all those things done. Yeah.
No, and I absolutely do not do it all. I don't edit. I could if I had to save my life and someone made something.
Okay. Yep.
I could
you just hand I it could, off. Like, here,
put I could survive, but I don't do motion graphics. I'm more, in directing and producing. So great. I think that's one of the coolest things about video and film is that, not that people can't do it by themselves, but to me, it's like really, really invigorating to work with a team. It's like the most collaborative, creative process. And then you see this end result that you all, you know, and sometimes a very large group had to be brought together to produce something like that. So it's pretty cool that it's not just individual effort.
I have a, let me see, there's a couple paths I could take here, but like, I want to kind of, you know, you started back in time and as you're young, and you started with very creative, I'm writing and dancing, made my parents watch that. And I want to kind of go back to that, but I'm actually, a question has emerged like immediately for me. So from so using creator as like a creative, right? That's kind of like you start there and then you kind of journey into this like drug and alcohol counseling and kind of like this other more social work kind of frame for a while, and then kind of come back to the creative life. And I'm curious, like, I don't know how that, when you think about like, I don't know, the role of creativity in our life and like what you encountered in that space, like how did it, just like muse on that journey a little bit. I'm sure there's something there to pick at.
Yeah, there definitely is. Like, I think there's a lot there, right? And I want to be careful to not to overgeneralize, but for myself, I think one, being curious, right? Curiosity to me is so connected to creativity.
Yes.
And trying to connecting dots, basically. And then the other aspect in terms of human beings, you know, like I mentioned, you know, really curious about what makes us do the things that we do, behave the way that we do. And I think, like many people, we follow paths where we're trying to maybe explore and sort our own, I don't know, trauma is too dramatic of a word, but you know what I mean? Like we bring things from our childhood and we try to make sense of those as adults. And I think for me personally, that was a big part of, you know, why I was drawn to working with people who have alcohol and drug addiction, abuse issues, family issues. You know, I worked a lot with women and women's issues. So I think just always really seeking to understand the human condition and ultimately then story becomes a huge part of that, right? You know, when you're in therapy with someone, you're listening and reflecting back and understanding and they're trusting you. Right. So there's a connection there that you make. And I think stories have a huge power to change people's lives. Right. And making them and change the world really, which is something I'm very interested in, is how do we help ourselves and others and the world change for the better.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, those things work really well. And frankly, as a creative, just being in a pure, like just in the advertising world, for instance, knowing how to relate to folks and knowing, and caring about human beings is really, really important to me. So
that's a very, there's so much in the answer. That's really good. Like the place of story, but also like the understand kind of the empathetic need in both places. Like you actually have to be able to listen. And it's communication, right? Like a lot of that kind of early stuff you studied. I mean, it's actually really quite interesting that you study psychology and communications and kind of like live at the overlap of those things, and how, and that is perfect for being a storyteller. Well, let's journey back to the little girl dancing and writing scripts. So specifically around this, like, you know, the show's kind of themed around work. And I try to ask everybody, like, what is the earliest memory you have of the word work taking on meaning in your, like, what did the word mean initially? Like, what was work? When did you learn what it was? And yeah, just what are some of the earliest memories you have there?
Yeah, such a great question. You know, I think that I have multiple answers.
Good.
For me, like growing up, I often saw my dad, you know, go to work. Sometimes it was a trip and he was gone and then come back from a trip. So it sort of signified some absence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just watching how your parents engage with work, I think is really influential, you know, in terms of maybe struggles that he had and in terms of different positions. My mom, the other aspect of this is my mom was a hospice nurse. She was a nurse for, oh my gosh, 63 years, maybe 50 some of them as a hospice nurse. She was a visiting nurse before that. So a lot of my shaping was from her, right? Like she worked and she was largely a single mom for much of my life. So she worked a day job. She worked a night job. She worked to put us through college. She worked all the time, and what she worked at was something that she very much respected and honored as like helping people at the end of their lives, you know? So how she approached her work, even though it was a lot, right? She worked a lot. Even so, it was this reverence and, importance in what she placed in what she was doing. She wasn't calling it in. Let's just put it that way.
That's good.
It was, really important to her. So, and I also think I learned a lot from how she cared about her work and the level of quality, integrity in what she did. And everyone knew that of her. So she passed away a couple of years ago, and that I got to hear a lot of stories about, this is the way Judy would have done it. And this is what she, you know, so it's nice to see this sort of legacy live in how she cared for her nursing work.
What about your earliest, your personal, so those are like the kind of influences in your life, which is, you're exactly right, speak a tremendous amount into like how you will kind of associate in that relationship in your own life. What are like some of the things that you worked at when you were youngest? You know, even, and by the way, even like referencing, I was writing, I was making scripts. I think it's important that these don't always need to be attached to the employment, right? That's actually part of mm-hmm. the thing I'm trying to get at with this show in general. You know, I work with a mm-hmm. ton of people that don't have jobs, but work is an important part of your life, even if you're not in an employment situation. And yeah, so just like, where do you remember working at things when you were young?
Yeah, definitely. As you said, that memories come up of, you know, I worked really hard at, I'm envisioning, this is funny because I'm not an Iron Maiden fan, but for whatever reason, I would sit in my bedroom, which was in the basement, and draw Iron Maiden covers.
The Trooper album cover. Or whatever. Yeah, they're yes, awesome.
Yes,
they're awesome.
Yes, like all the details, you know, these drawings. And I think back like, why didn't I choose a band I really, really loved? I don't know. But
or some less psychotic just, pictures.
Maybe. I don't know. But it felt like a challenge, right? Yeah, and yeah. And I think that there's some zone you get in, you know, when you're doing a creative process like that. And I remember working really hard at craft, whether that was drawing or dance. Mm-hmm. I was a ballet and modern dancer, and it was really important to me to excel and set a really high bar for myself in those areas. So I remember that from a very early age, just being very driven to do my best. Mm. And then in terms of employment, I started off in service. So in, you know, restaurants, fast food, bars, mm-hmm. which I really think everyone should.
Yeah.
frankly, you learn a lot, but even in that realm, like I feel like I've always had two or three concurrent jobs. Like when I was in high school and college, I would either have multiple jobs or I would have jobs that had pretty strong responsibilities in relation to my age, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like managing a shop at a very young age. So I took a lot of pride in that. And I think that was just part of my own overachieving and really wanting. I think many things about work are very connected to our value as human beings, right or wrong. But I know for myself, I've put a lot of value in that in terms of how I work and how I'm seen as a worker. So yeah, those are my.
I'm really, yeah, there's a couple things you said in there, but that last piece about connected to our value as a human being, I think, I'd like to kind of like double click on that a little bit. There's like a, you know, I've seen this with folks. I can only say like one point in my life I had value is one side and then identity a little bit. Like, so I had a brief season where I took like a couple, like a short sabbatical, took like a couple months to kind of really leave the day to day and spend some time I just went to another city and spent some time learning from some other folks or whatever. And I had a real experience of like, it was a strange experience of like, an identity shift where it's like, well, you know, there's a lot about, I think we wrap up a lot of like what we do and who we are. And then I think, as you're saying, like the value in a human being, like right or wrong, like related to, being worthwhile or something. Cause I do think there's ways in which some of us, and by the way, I think a lot of people, back to the addicts and stuff, it's like folks can be wildly productive and work very hard out of some sense of trying to measure up to something, out of like a very deep insecurity. You could be outrageously productive. Right.
Yes.
Whereas also like out of a sense of deep identity going like, I'm good. And because I'm good, I can overflow with productivity because but like not out of deficit, right? There's like different modes of being that can kind of lead to that productivity. And I do think like we get our sense of identity wrapped up in that. I even think a lot of times that like we ask little kids, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And by which we mean employment, by which we're asking them about a career. We're not asking what kind of person do you want to be? Or what kind of life do you want to live? But we're saying, what do you want to do for a living? When we say, what do you want to be? And that's an interesting question to me in terms of just like the, I don't know. I'm wondering if this is triggering any thoughts for you to like expand on this, like idea that there's something connected to our value as human beings in the work that we're doing. I think there's something really fascinating there.
I agree. And I'm so glad for the way that you articulated it because, and I don't know culturally, country by country, for instance, what that, but you're absolutely right. In America, we hear that from the time that we're very little, amongst other messages, right? That our both identity and value will be tied intrinsically to a career choice and career success.
Yeah.
And I think, it's fascinating, right? And why is that? And I definitely relate to that. I think, you know, look, we all carry some level of baggage, you know, from our childhood and choose different ways to work it out. And I know for myself, like I mentioned earlier, overachieving and, people say your work isn't you. I want to come back to that because I think that's an interesting thing to unpack, but, you're absolutely right. The expectations that we put on folks that this is what we want to know about you. Not are you going to be kind? How are you going to treat others? You know, what will you contribute to the world in this way, right? Beyond sort of really traditional careers. I mean, and that gets us into a whole other like gender type of, expectations as well. I think, what did I say? I just wanted to come back and unpack
your work. And I was going to remind you because I'm like, we are coming back to it. Your work isn't you.
Yes. So identity, I'm so glad you said that because I really struggle with that. Like I love what I do so much and I would not change a thing if I didn't have to work, I didn't have to pay bills. I didn't have to do all that. I would do exactly what I'm doing. And I think identity, like it would be really hard for me to not identify as a storyteller or a filmmaker or, you know, the realm in which that I'm currently also happen to be making a living. So I understand the reasons behind that sort of sentiment, but I just can't wrap my head around it personally. I can see how others should, right? In terms of how it might benefit their lives to have some separation between identity and career. But for me, it's just who I am, you know?
Yeah. And I think, no, I do. And this is one of the interesting things I think about these kind of like, and by the way, I don't know, it's weird. I feel like I'm meandering through this, but like it ties in with, you know, people talk about like work-life balance. And I always get a little like, I don't fully think that way because I don't think that my life is separate from my work.
Yeah.
And because my work grows out of who I am, like what you're saying about like, and I actually think this is an interesting distinction is like your work flows out of identity. Like, and you're like, if it wasn't about paying bills, it wasn't about there's no professionalization needed for this. And I actually really think a lot about the, and I'm not going to get this exactly right, but the etymology behind the word amateur. Like we use these words like amateur and professional, but it actually is like tied to like a more basically it's like, because it's like for the love of like you do that. An amateur does something for the love of it. And we always think like, well, pros are good at it and amateurs are not as good at it, but it's like, no, amateurs mean not paid. And a pro means paid. Like I think technically. Right. And it's like that an amateur could be better than, Or in my mind, I'm like, even though, and what I hear you saying is, even though I get paid, so technically I'm a professional, but even if I wasn't paid, I'm actually still an amateur. Like, as in, I still do this for the love of it's still, because especially for the creatives, this is why I was like really interested in speaking with you about this. Cause I think like the idea that you're not tied to your work is a little crazy when it's like, I'm a creator. Like, it's like, especially if I'm a maker of art, like that is a piece of me, a part of me, like a child, almost a creation of mine. And so there's like something that I bring into existence. It's like, of course, that's representative of the author or the artist or the one that like breathed it into existence. And then you're like, yeah, because as a core of your identity, you're like, I'm a storyteller. Mm-hmm. I'm a filmmaker. I happen to be paid for it, right? It's a professional. I can call it a career. It's respectable enough. But when I was a little kid, I was doing this.
Yeah.
And I probably couldn't see myself stopping. I think that's that is the kind of thing that now you're the kind of vocation then that gets to the, you know, there's a lot, by the way, with the way we have like workforce and after industrialization, like there's a lot of good in the idea of work-life balance and the 8-hour work, you know, work day. Mm-hmm. And like they fought hard to not have to have less like oppressive kind of like working on assembly lines. But earlier when you talked about getting in a zone, working on the Iron Maiden drawing, right? You're like, you said there's a zone you click into. Well, I actually think that's an indication of something, like you're doing something that's challenging and meaningful and you love. And by the way, if I'm in that space creating something, how dare you tell me I've been at it too long? Like I'm not going to have anybody tell me it's time to stop. You need to have a more balanced life. I'm like, no, I'm enraptured by some like a muse outside of myself. Like I'm in zone is like, no, I'm captive to this, not captive in like, I'm not free. I'm freely choosing to be in like this real relationship with my work that is timeless. And to me, I think that there's like something there, like an indication of something really powerful. I'd love to hear your thoughts on
that. I agree. And actually, just even going back, I'm so glad that you brought up the sort of word amateur and that meaning there, because I think words really matter.
Right.
And we have so many words, sayings, you know, things in our culture that we just accept and don't deconstruct. Mm-hmm. And that's a great insight that you just shared. I'd never even really thought about the word amateur and the love of. So I'm like totally digging that. So in terms of what was your other question? I was so stuck on amateur.
All good.
Sorry,
all good.
You just asked me another question.
Yeah, no, because I actually do think it's related to, you were talking about being in the zone.
Yes.
Like
yes.
I just think there's something about like, it's like if this, you know, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. This is like the quote they throw around, but there's something really true about that, where this isn't just money making work. Like I work hard at something, but it's what I love. Just like mom with the nursing. It's like you said, she had a reverence for this work. It had a level of importance that was probably not just, I need a paycheck. By the way, I need a paycheck.
Yeah.
But that's not maybe why I'm here initially.
Right. I think that to me that, what's related to what you just said in terms of what sparked in my head is that a lot of times people say like, oh, I'm not creative, right? A lot of people say I'm not creative.
And so there's these
classes of like, I'm creative, I'm not creative. And I really think that human beings are creative inherently. They're born that way. It might be, you know, taught out of them or self-taught out of them, but ultimately creativity is originality, is making connections, connecting the dots and problem solving, right? And so I think that people do that much more than they think. They're employing these creative skills and creativity in a way that it just doesn't fit the, okay, I'm not painting, right? Or I'm not doing whatever, but yet they're doing this other thing, right? That is inherently human and creative. And even if you're in, I think like the empathy comes back to that too, that's related to creativity too, right? People caring about other people, and back to story. So I don't know, all of those things feel like so naturally connected in my world that it would be hard to say, to think about them in any other way, you know?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, my wife is someone that says I'm not creative. And it was funny, she said this recently. And I said, well, okay, little context. My wife, are you familiar with the like big five, like the temperament kind of thing? Like the acronym is like OCEAN. No. So if not, no. I'll, for those listening too, I'll just rattle it off real quick. So there is this, it's like a personality typology, but it's more temperamental. Mm-hmm. And it's measured on, it's kind of the closer one to like having a science behind it, where it's based on a population survey. So we survey the population. And so out of 100 people, you're at this percentile in these five categories. Mm-hmm. So they use the acronym OCEAN. So openness would be one. And then there's like, you could give like description of what openness looks like. That's a lot of associated with creativity a lot. Conscientious. So this would be like, I'm orderly and I'm an industrious person, right? So I'm in this way, pretty middle of the road, like conscientious, like I'm very industrious, but I'm not very orderly. And so that like gives me in the middle of conscientious kind of balance or whatever. But then you have, what are they? Extroversion. Then there's agreeableness. By the way, I rank almost off the charts low on agreeable. Like they're like in a room of 100 people, there is one person less polite than you, which is crazy to me. I just rank off the charts low. And then there's neuroticism. Now, neuroticism in this sense is a temperamental feature, I mean, prone to negative emotion, fear and that kind of thing. It's not, and it's important for me to like lay this out in all of these, because it's not like neurotic, like it's used to, like people use it like as crazy, right? But it's a, and I'm actually, by the way, really low in that as well. Well, my wife is really high neurotic. Okay. So I wanted to give you that for this context, right? This is very high neurotic. So there's always like, you know, she's worried of what's going to go wrong, anticipating all these problems, like just constantly, right? Like she's just, things are going to break. Things are going to go wrong. I'm scared. Like thing, you know, I feel negatively about certain things that happen. And it's just a temperamental, like people are just part of the DNA makeup of, this is an important lens of diversity, I think, a human diversity. So, and by the way, it's a great feature to have around. I'm going to be alive a lot longer by pairing up with someone who sees the snakes. You know what I mean? And so that's good. Well, the other night she said, I'm not creative. And it's funny, and it was related to this, but like it was instant. I was like, you're one of the most creative people I've ever met. Like, what? And I was like, yeah, you just create monsters. Like you create monster scenarios. Like the amount of, we were watching one day, we were watching a film. What was the film? I'm not going to remember, but it was horrific. Like it was like this, these two tribes like warring, and like, I mean, one's invading another. And so there's all these like just horrific stuff happening to these characters, like, you know, and I looked at her, I'm like, man, isn't this brutal? And she goes, I've imagined every one of these scenarios happening to me.
Oh my God.
like why? Why would you have done that? And that's just, and it was just interesting, like back to the, like, I actually think the way you were fleshing out creativity is a really, like a really good one, because you're like, you're into problem solving and relationship and kind of that empathetic piece. And I also think it's interesting, like just using my wife as an example here, is like creativity is actually still quite, it's funny. As soon as I said it, she's like, you know, you're actually right. Like I am creative. I just put all that creative energy into something that's maybe not helping a whole lot. But I am pretty good at it. Like I could tell you a million ways this is going to go wrong.
Interesting. Yeah. That's where her mind is spending its time and energy, is creating these things.
But it's in you. It's still there. It's still there. It's like calling up these things.
Huh. Wow.
Now I know, interesting, like you have, so I'm going to kind of change course here a little bit. So you've got, let me not jump ahead too far. So with these early, kind of childhood, kind of, you had these early career jobs, right? And then you had like this creativity. By the way, real quick, why do you think, you made a comment when you said, I went into like food service, restaurants, fast food, bars, By the way, I think everyone should have some experience there. Why?
Because I see a lot of people treat service workers like shit.
Ah.
And I hate it. I hate it. Like they're less than human. Like there's some other class of person when you don't know a single thing about them, right? Or where they came from or what they're doing. And I just hate entitlement. I hate.
There we go.
But that's the way
no,
it is.
Let's go. No. Okay. So empathy. That's so that you would know what it's like to be on the other side of this exchange.
Right. And who's to say that, you know, if we even call it the service industry, but you know, we're people that are bringing us, you know, food when we go out or a drink, you know, that's an experience, right? I don't like the power exchange and I don't like the freedom that many people feel to just be rude, to feel entitled to be served a certain way, to not recognize other people, whether it's with a tip or whether it's with eye contact. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's the one area, like service workers and food service, that it's you just it's very apparent to me. It's probably happens in a lot of different, you know, realms, but to me that's one that I just find very visible, and it's always been one, like, it's affected how I treat service workers, it's affected how I tip, you know, and I think it's just a real huge sign of character.
That's great. I'm glad I circled back to that. Speaking of character, I don't know if this is directly coming from that, but like, you seem like, as I look at kind of like, you know, stalked you a little bit, looking at work you're doing, you've been very involved with, so 3% Movement, Women in Media, the Alliance of Women Directors. Seems like this kind of like representation in the craft has been a really important piece, like, alongside your work, a piece of your work and what you're aiming to do. I'd love to hear, like, just, I don't know, hear more about that. Tell us about those entities, about your experience with them, about why that's like a big, maybe something you're contributing a good chunk of your bandwidth to. Like, I just love to hear, like, what's drawing you there? I mean, there's some, I think, things, some obvious maybe reasons, but like, I'd love to hear you articulate them.
Yeah. I'll come at it from two different ways. The first is very factual, right? I worked brand side. I did not work in agencies at the beginning of my career. I worked at a college and at an insurance company, actually. So I came to know Kat Gordon, who's the founder of the 3% conference, which is now called the 3% Movement. And found out through their research that only 3% of women were creative directors, and yet 85 or more percent of people making purchasing decisions are women, right? So kind of learned a lot through that. I didn't come to it like many do, with blatant discrimination in my job, you know, or feeling like I didn't get a position or a raise because of my gender. I came to it through finding this organization and learning more about the research, and then sort of was drawn into, okay, now, and then I had an agency job and met lots of folks and understood the inequities and lack of diversity, lack of equity throughout the advertising industry, as well as beyond. It's not just advertising. It's many different, you know, industries. So that was fascinating to me. And the other facet that I wanted to bring to this was not just the sort of academic one, but one of, I feel very driven by justice. Like, I was just emailing someone this morning about it, and I used it in a term of, like, I think a lot of people in my work in the creative industries feel like there's a similar magnet that draws us to justice. I don't know why, but I feel it really strongly. And it's in everything that I do, that, like, this should not be this way. People should not be treated this way. People, you know, like, anything that has to do with that, I want to know, like, why, yeah, why? And I feel very strongly about fighting that and fighting for justice in a variety of ways in our culture and in our business world. So yeah, that's shaped me a lot.
I'm really interested. I mean, I have a, I would say I have a, I feel a similar drive and pull magnet, as you put it. And then I also wonder, as you use the word justice, like, are you able, so this is an interesting challenge, I think. So I was wrestling with this the other day, like what is that? Like, what, you get what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, honestly, I don't know globally what it is. Like when I said, I see a lot of creative folks feel the same way, or, mm-hmm. or I could speak more to personally yep. why, you know, mm-hmm. and again, through my own childhood experiences and things that I've seen and witnessed and things that have happened to me, like I'm sure that that has shaped, but I just feel so, and I'm not saying this is my place. Like, I don't want to be a Karen in the world, but like, I don't, who am I to fight for other people's rights? You know what I mean? But I just feel strong. Like I'm actually looking, oh my gosh, my windbreaker right across my chair here is from Colin Kaepernick's I Know My Rights. mm-hmm. And I, when it comes to racial injustice and LGBTQ community and what people really close to me in those communities have experienced, I just, it's just in my heart. Like I cannot, that's talk about identity, right? Mm-hmm. That is just who I am. I would never be able to separate that from any, anything that I do or any job that I took or, you know, groups that I was part of. It's just who I am.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, I've wondered about this, like even kind of what the move is. And even as you associate it with creatives, is like, there's a way in which I wonder if we're not, you know, there's, cause even defining justice, right, is a tough thing to do that actually, like, it's like, well, it's a moving target. Mm-hmm. I could tell you which direction it is in, but maybe not what it ultimately looks like. And like, when you see, so you go, when I see something that shouldn't work that way, I think, well, it's obvious which way the needle needs to move in. Like mm-hmm. it, we know which direction, which cardinal direction it's in maybe. And I always think about, you know, I think a lot of our work here in Tampa, you know, we work a lot with folks that are on the streets and we work with a lot of people, whether food insecurity or lack of housing and transportation, mm-hmm. all these other things. And I often think of like our work as a kind of performance art where we're pretending that the world isn't like it is. And we're rehearsing a reality that we dream of. Right. So rather than like thinking like when you earlier, you said like, you know, how to change the world, that was a, like story becoming a big part of your thing and moving like from both in counseling to in creation or filmmaking, like how to change the world. And I don't know, one of the, let's say a theory of change, I guess, that I've adopted is like in embodiment. Like, well, you can try to like enact a reality like in your own company or in your own household or in your own neighborhood. Whereas like that, because, and I guess one of the reasons that appeals to me is that is under my control as opposed to like the way that the whole system works or something. There's some things we can contribute to or move the needle on in that, but like, it isn't as under my, so I can get really upset about that, but then also like locally go, why don't we try to create a community that looks like the one that we dream of? And it feels like an act of creation. Like it's like, it, mm-hmm. and you know, it feels like, well, that's art in some sense or creation in some sense, like trying to move it toward some vision of, you know, the world that we dream of or hope for or mm-hmm. something like that. And I think where you're like, it's interesting. You said driven and feel pulled like a magnet. And it's like, those are interesting words in terms of that something ahead of you pulling you, like mm-hmm. the future pulling you into it. And mm-hmm. then something like your past driving you, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's actually, I just thought that was interesting. Like it used words that were from both sides of you. Like I'm compelled.
Yeah. It doesn't feel even though I talk a lot about intention, and I think a lot of things that we need to do, especially in the space of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, has to be intentional. Like, mm-hmm. we need to intentionally make decisions, right, to work towards those things. But going back to being driven or being pulled, like, in some ways, I feel like I have no choice. Like, it's so in my DNA.
Yep.
There's just no choice. And I'm fine with that.
Yeah, that's, man, there's something like feels like related in these, both to the, like, the identity and the pursuit of justice. Like, there's a way in which your life seems like really surrendered to some like vocation, some calling, some vocation, something that you're like on the path of, where it's like, this is just who I am and what mm-hmm. I work toward. Now talk to, you know, as we were talking about like your work not being you before, and actually like the idea of creations of mm-hmm. yours, like, I'd love to hear, like, how have you related to your work in terms of the products of your work, your creations? Mm-hmm. Like, I know a lot of those you do for hire and they're not yours at all. You're handing them mm-hmm. off. Maybe some of them you've done as passion projects or the mm-hmm. everything in between. Just, I don't know. Talk to me a little bit about like the relationship you have with the work of your hands mm-hmm. as it exists after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely. I think both in the product and the process, mm-hmm. they're both, hopefully both affected by my values, right? So it's not just the output, but it's the way in which we go on about the journey together and the process there. I think, I'll just kind of talk about a couple different things. You know, from a crewing perspective, it's really important to me. A lot of this is integral to like the work at the 3% movement. It's really important to me for representation in media, because that shapes our culture mm-hmm. and shapes the world, right? And so I don't think any one particular identity group should be the only one making media or being portrayed in media. Mm-hmm. And I think we're a much better world when we have diversity and inclusion and equity in those spaces behind and in front of the lens. So when I work on stories and when I crew up, I try to do that with intention mm-hmm. In terms of who's on my crews. I try to put pronouns on my call sheets. I seek to not have, you know, homogenous crews when it comes to gender and race. So just being the process of it being attentive and intentional there. In terms of the product, I think the types of stories that I like to work on and like to elevate are also very related to that. Mm. A couple of examples would be, this summer I produced a feature with a group in Wilmington, North Carolina, two very good friends of mine who own a production company there called Honeyhead. They're an all women production company. And our feature film had 70% female and non-binary crew. And that was intentional, right? And it's also a story about, it's a women-led, female-led film. I'm currently working on another feature around drug-facilitated sexual assault. So the topics and the types of stories and types of projects that I want to be involved with, whether I'm writing them or producing them or helping them get developed and see the light of day, also trying to be very intentional about those and those in both their process and their outcome being beneficial to the world.
How much is the product? So the process and product is a very good and clear distinction that I appreciate. And I'm extracting it from the work that you do to go, that's, you know, in all of our work, there's kind of the journey and mm-hmm. the output, right? And so I'm curious, like, how much, and what comes to mind is a quote about, I just think about, like, it's kind of means and ends a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I want to say it was Gandhi maybe, that said, like, the ends are contained within the means, mm-hmm. something like that. And like, it's, you know, in contrast with the means, just the ends justify the means or something. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how much you think that product, so back to your own craft, how much does the product, the quality of the product, the authenticity of the product, the nature of the product that exists, how much of that is because of the process? Like, does it, like, if you focus in on the process, does it guarantee the product? You get what I'm asking? Like,
yeah, totally get what you're asking. Yeah. I think they're certainly symbiotic, but I don't know that they guarantee anything. Right.
Yeah. That was righteous how we did that. The product sucked.
Right. Exactly. And I think, you know, just thinking about like, my commercial work and working in the advertising industry, I've long said, you know, I'm not really all that interested in helping sell plastic Ziploc bags. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
I have much more interest in helping companies that, to me, feel like they're values driven and creating something in the world. And so have I done work for other, you know, companies like that? Sure. Is the craft well done? Yes. Mm-hmm. Does the product ultimately have a huge impact on the world in the way I would want? Maybe not. You know what I mean? So, but it's the work that we do, and not every single thing checks all those boxes.
Yep.
But I do think that the process always matters. You know, when we have limitations that we can't always impact every aspect of that of the outcome, you know,
yep.
but we can impact and decide on every aspect of our contribution. And if our contribution in that process, how I treat people on set, how I interact with folks and honor human beings and how they feel, mm-hmm. like that, we have a lot of control over. That almost matters more. Like, I'm sort of hesitating saying that because it's not, I definitely care about my craft and my output, yeah. you know, but at the end of the day, and I don't know if this is nihilist or what the correct philosophical term is, but like, we're all going to die. Right. And so what really matters, right? Like what really matters is the journey, not to be so cliche, but like the path that we walked, who we walked it with and how we walked it. Right.
Yeah. No, I am definitely on the side of process. I think you're exactly right. By the way, that is not nihilistic at all. maybe slightly existentialist because we're gonna, I mean, that's why I have this guy back here, right? This is the memento mori. It's like, no, the most important thing to remember is this all ends.
Nihilist was in my head because I love the movie Big Lebowski and he says it.
He's a nihilist.
I probably got the reference wrong, but you got me.
Such a good movie. No, so but I think that's it. I think that's exactly right. Okay. So then so this is a question I try to ask everybody, but feels like this is the moment to ask it on the back of you saying that, like, how do you measure, what is success?
I think success is part integrity, right? Like, did I do my best? Can I sleep at night? Did I do the right thing? You know, going back to values driven, mm-hmm. like that feels integral to success. And did it matter to human beings? Like, did it matter? Not like how many impressions or the reach or, you know, sales, but like, did it make a difference to somebody? And maybe that's all like rosy sunshine, whatever glasses, but like, I hope that that's like, at the end of the day, that's really kind of how I feel. Like when I do a lot of documentary and docu style storytelling and I make a lot of things in that space. And I always think about all the people I've interviewed, and sometimes the videos are fantastic and they're successful and whatever, but sometimes, you know, they're just a video. But those people, the fact that they say, Thank you so much for telling my story. This meant so much to me, you know, that they were able to open up to a stranger in their home. And like the telling of their story became part of that healing or journey. Like, that's the coolest thing to me. No. Right. So I don't know if I should have shared that or not, but like, that's just part of the path and the process that feels like it mattered to somebody. Maybe it was just one person, but it really, how I treated them really mattered.
Yeah, I've had some interviews like some of these that I've done where afterwards people were like, this was like really helpful, like therapeutic almost, because of the listening or asking certain questions, especially as you kind of like journey back in time. Yeah. Just depending on, it depends on the person or the timing or how much they've thought about these things at all.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like for you, as an interviewer, like it seems like maybe some of your background in counseling and psychology, like how much do you think that is like a trained you up to be a empathetic kind of interviewer, like that that's kind of a product of, you know, now when you interview someone, they're like, oh my God, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. 100%. I feel so thankful to have, you know, had that period of time in my life where it wasn't where I wanted to go eventually as a career, but it shaped me in so many ways. And I'll tell you, it was rough in my 20s, being sort of in this space where I wasn't necessarily well prepared or trained for what I was getting into, but I did it. And it was at times awkward and uncomfortable. And I may have not been, you know, said things I should have said, you know what I mean? Like I wasn't perfect, but boy, did I learn. And it's really stuck with me and shaped who I am. So I think it's a huge, huge aspect of being able to connect with people. You know, that's really important to me.
It's it seems like it's unbelievably valuable. I'm curious. So as we're talking, you said at one point, like, forget exactly, I think you said my first son at one point. You're a mom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how many kids do you have?
Oh my God, do I get to talk about my kids?
I want to talk about your kids. Well, I imagine you invest in these relationships and that you're working hard to make sure. Yeah, tell me about your kids.
Oh my God, I have two grown feminist sons, and they are the best. And I didn't make them that way. They chose their path. My oldest is 26. He is a film composer, musician, sound designer, creative, kind of in awe of all of that. He went to Berkeley and lived in New York for a couple of years and is headed to LA, I think.
Jeez.
Yeah. I'm kind of a fan of both my kids. I suppose all moms are, but whatever. And then my youngest is here in Boulder, and he was a biology major and a women's and gender study minor, and wants to be a large animal vet. So yeah, they're
both. How old is he?
He's 23. Yeah.
So they're a little older than I was imagining, but that's, it doesn't matter. So if I'm curious about this topic and the kind of relationship to work. So like, if I were to ask them about their earliest memories of work, and if I were asking them, like if I was interviewing them and having this interview with them, like, do you have any sense of, or both what you think it might be, but also what you would hope maybe it would be in terms of lessons instilled or something like that? I think they're old enough now, you probably have some ideas of like what landed, you know, but what might, like, do you have any thoughts of like how was there intentionality around this when they were young with their own relationship with like doing hard things and sacrificing and creating? I know it sounds like one became like fully like a creative, right? Talk to me about that, like in terms of like nurturing that ethic, that work ethic, or that creator in them, and kind of like how they might answer those questions.
Yeah. Oh, such an interesting topic. And I've ever really thought about like articulating in a conversation like this, but it brings up a lot of things for me to think about. I think for my oldest, you know, someone who is, there was no other choice, right? Like he is in his heart creative and there wasn't a choice to go to like a regular college instead of a music college, you know, like was drawn to it or driven or pulled, like we said earlier, right? Yep. It was his destiny. And he works, we kind of laugh because like sometimes we'd have to, you know, bribe and you know, you got to get your homework in, you got to do this, that, right? But when it came to music, nothing, you know, he was totally did it on his own, right? So the things that were important to him, he was self-driven around and, you know, has made a career out of that for himself. So it's like the coolest thing to see.
It's amazing.
And and then my other son is like extremely conscientious and responsible and just got a raise at work. And you know what I mean? They're both, I think, have good relationship with work. But what's interesting is, and I think this is, might be a little generational, is that both of them and their friends and, you know, girlfriend, whatnot, have a different relationship with work than I think I do and people of my generation. Like they feel much more balanced. Nobody is working, you know, 100 hours a week and sacrificing this. Like they've got it figured out what's important in life. Like they're responsible and having jobs, yet also like really valuing life and relationships. So it's very cool to see how they've, you know, they're not replicas of me or my husband or combo. They're their own people. They figured out their relationship with work in a way that they want healthy. It's amazing.
Wow, that's so cool. So no grandkids yet though. They're
not yet.
Okay. Not yet. Yeah, I was like 26. All right, we're still.
Yeah. I don't know how family planning in today's generation goes. They can't even afford to buy a house. You know, like the housing prices these days. It's a whole other level.
Things they have
to deal with.
Yeah. And then sometimes it just happens and you're like, well, I guess we're going to figure that out.
Yep, exactly.
Turns out I'm a creator. man, I want to circle back to the statement you made earlier about like, sometimes you go into this zone. I've always been, I am very interested. Like, you know, this is an actual like measurable state that people go into. I'm curious about your own experiences throughout your life. So you were referencing being quite young, drawing Iron Maiden, but I imagine throughout your life, you go to this place. I want to hear about what your experience of that is, flow, the zone, whatever you want to call it. What your experience of it is there things that put you there, or is there certain kinds of work that put you there? What's your experience of that place? Do you have any like ideas about it being I'll use the word meaningful, like there's some meaning to that happening, because I kind of do, and I wonder if you do as well. Like, just talk to me about your experience with like the state of flow.
I have a couple thoughts on that. I think for me, growing up and having some dysfunction and things in the world that I had to sort through, I found that reading was an escape. And so I spent a lot of time reading books. And so story and sort of imagination was my foundation and my survival mechanisms in many ways. And I think that leads to all of the other things I'm about to say. I think that zone wise for myself, if I don't have time to let my mind wander and do what it needs to do, and that's usually when I'm running, sometime showering, driving, but these
moments where I can put my body into autopilot and my mind can just be let to drift. If I didn't have that, I would dramatically crumble and die. So, you know, I've spent a lot of my life thinking, oh, I'm an extrovert. I love people. I love meeting people. But I've realized recently, like, I'm actually probably what they would maybe call an introvert in terms of needing this time to refresh, refill my pitcher. Like, that is when I come up with creative solutions. And it's when I come up with creative ideas. And I have learned to structure my day to allow that, or I become extremely depleted and I have nothing to give. I have no way to create or give if I don't have that time built in.
Real quick, I want to say, like, I have a very, I even say it the same way. Like, I need space for my mind to wander and do exactly what it wants to do.
Yes.
And I need that space. And I do associate it with introversion, and creativity also. Like, it's like weird products come out of that time, but not because I went into it to think about something. I just, like, right, needed space to, like, meander the whatever in my mind. And it does feel like I'll crumble and die without it. And, you know, recently, I had a, you know, my wife and I have only been, we've been married now, you know, 2 years. And I realized, like, moving in together and having this, like, I had to tell her at one point, like, hey, like, I need to figure something out here for, like, space. Mm-hmm. We're both introverted, but we're together in a house and we love each other and we're talking about things. But I'm like, I realized, oh, I would have done that at this point in the evening or whatever. Yes. Like, I would have just sat and stared at that wall, but, like, right, you want to talk to me. And I realized, like, uh-oh, something's missing. And it took me a while to even realize that that's what was happening. But and then I finally was able to articulate it to her, like, I need like space, like, to think. Well, think about, mm-hmm, what? And I'm like, right, actually, no, like, to just let it be. And then you started rattling off, like, shower, bathroom. And I'm like, that's when it happens. Cause, like, it's the only time you're by yourself. Yes. But right, no, that's that resonated so deeply with me. And it's, and by the way, the introversion, extroversion thing. And I want to go back to you answering this question, cause I think you had a few things to say, but, like, the introversion of needing space to recharge, let your mind wander, I think that's an associated with, like, an introverted personality. But on that temperamental thing that I talked about before, mm-hmm, the temperamental scale, I rank pretty high extroversion. Mm. And I realized those aren't the same thing. So, mm-hmm, I have an extroverted temperament, which means I am assertive and enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. Like, and so I read, people don't look at me or listen to me, like, engage and go, you're an introvert. But, mm-hmm, like, this isn't what fills me with energy.
Right.
Like, it isn't what replenishes that thing you're talking about. And that actually is a measure of something. Like, I'm like, oh, I'm wildly introverted. Mm-hmm. I desperately need to go be alone after we do whatever we do, you know?
Right.
Anyway, right. So, yeah, continue. But I just wanted to say, like, amen.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny that you brought that up in terms of relationships, right? Like, even if you're both introverted, like, my husband and I have been married 32 years, and he, good chunk of that, he was a firefighter. So he would work 24 hours and then have 48 off. And I joke, like, oh, how have you been married so long? Well, because we have a day without each other, right?
And bye.
But in a way, like, mm-hmm, and now that he moved on from that job, retired from firefighting and moved to a different job, we've had to sort of reset terms of, like, okay, what does, and I work at home now, right?
New, so
what
rules is that? Of engagement.
Exactly. And it doesn't mean, mm-hmm, this, you know, to the relationship, but what does it mean to the human beings? Yeah. And he's also a musician, so he needs creative this. And so it's just, yeah, figuring out, like, what we need as creative souls, mm-hmm, and then how, and what we need is, you know, spouses and, yeah, you know, interacting with others or, you know, friends or whatever, roommate, you know, it doesn't matter. But recognizing that for myself, and actually it's been part of my balancing producing, which is a very controlling job with, you know, directing and creative, some creative stuff, which I need to not let that part of my life be taken over by producing. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have to structure my life though, so that I allow the creative soul to thrive too, not just this really strong producer side.
To be clear, because that I think I get it, but producer is a little more direct, no, because director means something else in filmmaking, but managerial, like it's more business, like we're getting this stuff done. Mm-hmm.
Budgets, schedules, crew, you know, a lot of logistics.
More now, boss lady than artist or whatever.
Maybe, yeah. A lot of producers, like I consider myself a creative producer because I'm also working in the development of the story. Content. But producing is a lot of, I like to say, like, not control freak, but control enthusiast. But you're mitigating risk, right? And you're trying to control as many factors as you can so that the creative can thrive and the shoot, you know, can run seamlessly, et cetera. I could easily let that part of my soul take over, right? And not allow for the creative part. Mm. So it's been an interesting balancing act.
So I think I took us on a little bit of a side journey, but you said I would escape using story books, right? And then story and imagination became foundational. And then you said, mm-hmm. I started to realize if I don't have time for my mind to wander, but I'd asked you about flow state and your experience with that. You said, I have a few things to say.
Yes.
And then I kind of started riffing on what you had said initially. So I wanted to kind of steer us back and see if we could pick that back up.
Yeah. I guess the other thing I was going to say was, you know, sort of referencing Elizabeth Gilbert's TED talk with creativity, not being originating within us, but being in the ether, like in the universe. And sometimes it's going to just float by and maybe we'll catch it. You know what I mean? And have this sort of allow it to happen. And I often wonder about that because I can't sit down and say, you know, I am now going to write an amazing script and I am now going to come up with this idea. Like, it just doesn't work that way. Nope. You know, it's going to come at a different time and at a different process than I'm going to prescribe. And so is that related to our mind wandering? Is it related to creativity really being a larger thing than something that's just my own or any given person's like creative excellence? You know what I mean? Like, maybe it is outside of us and we're just vessels. So I think that's an interesting thing to think about. And even more so, it makes us realize well, if creativity is going to flow by, then we better stop and let it settle in us for a while, right? Or it's just going to flow right by and we won't experience it.
You know, that's so interesting. It's funny because you can kind of move into almost religious language with those things, but I think that it's fairly appropriate and not even at all, but if I remember right, because the idea that it's outside yourself, right? Mm-hmm. There's like it's this thing going by, but I actually think that's right. And historically, when they would call that a muse, right? Like there's this spirit that's going to it's, you know, like we have ideas, but ideas have us. Like there's a way in which something chooses its creator, it's time for me to be born. Right. And there's a muse that grabs us. And if I remember right, that is a little bit what she was talking about. Right. And then when you're gripped by a muse, and I guess this is the association you're making with flow state, and you enter into relationship with it, because there is an experience of something, you know, let's just say I used to do a lot of drawing and painting, and that would have been a place that this happened to me a lot. But where it's like, you know, I don't know, maybe I remember mom busting in and be like, it's time for dinner. And I was like, one, don't interrupt me. Two, how can it be time for dinner? I just started, but it's been the entire day. Right. Yes. So it was timeless. Yes. I forgot you guys existed. Also, I don't want to stop. Like, this is going to be really hard for me to pull out of this, state that I have fallen into that seems a little this is outside yourself is what to me has always seemed like a taste of eternal life or something. Like there's it went so timeless. So it's this is the, you know, what religions seem to be describing in place of just this timeless bliss state of yes. presence and creativity and whatever. I'm totally. Curious, like, yeah, I hear you, like, yeah, just tell me what's coming to mind.
Well, I think what came to mind was, is that there is no way that I can enter that zone moment or mm-hmm. chunk of time or whatever we want to describe it in the morning if my house is dirty and there's something I need to do on my list. Like, there's this sense that I need to
be free.
Check off. Yes. Check, mm-hmm. check whatever might be like nagging at me off so that I can be free. Cause I don't know if that free is going to be 1 hour or 10 hours. And if I can't know in my brain that I can just let it go for as long as it needs to go, I won't even turn it on. Like if I only have an hour to do something, it's not going to be like that. I'll tell you what I'm going to do in that hour, 10 phone calls, a budget, da, 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 da. You know, I'm not going to sit there and say, I have time to let some creative marinating happen because it'll have to be turned off and that'll be like, no. So it really yeah. does need to be this sort of open-ended freedom or window ahead that really allows me to let go and get into it.
I'm really curious now. So, cause what I hear is there's almost like a necessity. So there's a few things that you're saying. So one is I need to have some kind of a discipline that creates space and openness mm-hmm. In general, like mentally to just wander and like to allow there to be, to allow that idea to even get my attention, first mm-hmm. of all. But then like, when I really want to sit down and like develop that thing, it seems like you're saying like, I have to, the phrase that came to mind is set the table. Mm-hmm. Like I have to set the table properly. Like, okay, we got to clear off all these other things that are going to just be distracting yeah. and whatever. Yeah. So like I have to make space and then I have to make space. Exactly. Like there's a discipline of this, like making space to be open to these things.
It's a discipline, but it's yep. also like anxiety.
Okay. Tell me
to
more.
To be honest. Yeah. Like I think that creativity can't really thrive when you're like, afraid or anxious or, you know what I mean? Like it's creativity is not a fearful thing. It's the opposite. And so I think that for me, it's sort of mitigating all those things and like wiping them off the plate. What would I be worried about? What would I be, you know, anxious about, or what feels unsettling, even if it is just like, okay, now the house is in order. You know what I mean? Like yeah. it has that feeling of Zen. Now I can do so. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's really good. Now, if you let's say you did all that and you're in the like the throes of the idea, the muse, and something emerges in life, right, around you. I'm curious how well you do with like prioritizing that state. So like, are you easily pulled out of that? Or have you figured out pretty good ways of like, so protecting it? So you're setting the table for it to exist. You go, okay, I've got enough space for this. I mean, obviously there's things that are going to rip you out of, like the kids or something happened with the kids or whatever, but like, yeah. you know,
yeah.
But now all of a sudden it's like, oh, a chore comes up or you know, thing. Have you built up like abilities to go, I'm going to pause that for later to leave myself this space to kind of protect the sacred space that I've set aside?
I suck at that.
Yeah, no, I suck at that. Yeah, that sounds great. No.
I do a pretty decent job when I go on a run my phone's not right in front of me. People yeah. aren't really reaching me. And so I have a bit of a certain time and a certain route that I go. And so I feel like that's protected, but if I'm at home, it becomes very unprotected. I'm not good at that. And I need to work on it because I let a lot of things seep in and I haven't quite figured that out yet. And I don't know if it's a room or a space, or it's just a matter of building, like being a little stronger with that particular muscle. But I know that that's something I need to work on better, because it's really easy to let things in life pull me out of that if I'm a home environment.
Yeah. No, I mean, Yeah, could be hard. demands life. Get made. Yep.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things. There's just a lot of life.
For those that are listening, I'm wondering if there's any places you want to like point people, ways that they could follow you, connect, you know, whatever. Like, just kind of, are there things to ask of the audience, or just say like, here's ways you can see my work or find our stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm on Instagram. I think that's probably where I'm sharing most of the visual storytelling, you know, visual story related stuff. So there's Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn quite a bit because I'm interested in workplace culture, you know, yeah. And just kind of keeping a pulse on how that is changing, which I find interesting. And then Twitter.
And is your handle just your name, or what would they put in?
Yeah. On Twitter, it is my name, Andrea Nordgren. And on Instagram, it's A Nordgren.
Nice. Well, I know you've been doing a good bit of traveling and probably could use a little rest between these. I'm so grateful that you've been able to just take this time and share some of this process. Is there anything that I should ask you before we go?
That you should ask me.
That's okay.
What's my favorite movie? No.
Hold on. That actually we may not be wrapping up. Hold on. No. First of all, what is your favorite movie? By the way, I'll just start this with, because I want you to answer this. I'm so excited you said that. So when I was young, I think I've alluded to, like, I was always an artist, right? Could paint, draw, whatever. But I loved movies. Like, I just obsessively watched movies, especially like through high school. I was in a head-on car accident when I was 17. So at the end of my high school, I was really into film. And then at the end of my high school, my senior year, I was in a head-on car accident, broke every single bone in my face. Oh my God. I was laid up almost. I missed almost the entire school year. I was like on the couch, 'cause I'd had a bunch of abdominal surgery. I had legs broke, like so much was busted. So I was on the couch most of what would have been my senior year. And I just went into straight up like film school. Like, I just gave my mom like, you know, this is back when Blockbuster, like, here, run and see if they have these and run and see if they have these. And I was going through all the old movies and films. I got really into film and actually and started writing a script at that time, and convinced myself that like, I was going to go to film school. I was like, oh, I'm going to be a filmmaker.
Oh my God.
Of course I didn't do any of this. In fact, when I did graduate high school, so FSU has a film school there, and I was going to apply. I got the application all together, and it was really like, send in a film you've made, and you know, you go through, write all this stuff that, you know, for the application process. And I realized they were going to take 30 students, and 15 of them were going to be from within FSU already. I was like, so they're going to accept 15 students, and I don't have a film to send. And so I just never applied, and I moved on with my life. But all that to say, like, oh no, I was like really geeky into film and movies still. Just like, it's my favorite kind of pastime. You want, like, what do you want to do when there's free time? I'm like, movies. Yeah. So what is, maybe give me your top three, like, what are your favorites?
Well, it's funny that I proposed this question, because I can never answer it. There's no way. Well, it's a joke. Yep. There's no way that I have a single favorite movie, because there's all these genres and all, you know, that, and I'm so like voracious about.
Okay. But something came to mind, and your mind goes, yeah, but like, that was like a childhood favorite, or yeah, but it's not the greatest film of all time. Like, so I'll tell you one that's like, my wife actually said it when this came up. She's like, Tombstone. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I've watched Tombstone. I know every word of that movie by heart. And I've watched it so many times. And I think it's great. But I'm not like, this is one of the best movies ever made. I'm just like, it is one of my favorites, though. Like,
yeah,
I love that movie.
Great, right? Yeah, they like movies bring you different feelings for different reasons, right? And Tombstone has, you know, this set of things that are like so awesome about it and make you feel this way. And it's a great movie, great movie. And I think there's others that are great for totally different reasons. Usually,
so what are the ones that came to mind though? What are the ones that came to mind?
I would tell you. So I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan.
Okay.
Huge, huge, huge. And this is not my favorite movie of all time, but it's a damn good movie, is No Country for Old Men.
I love that movie. Okay.
Yeah. I like that genre. I think those directors, writers are amazing. I lean towards a little bit more of the dark side, you know, tension and suspense and thriller and drama and whatnot. It wasn't going to be a romantic comedy. I'll just tell you that. That's not going to be on my top 10 list of great movies, but yeah, I like so many. I could never answer the question. So
I have a question about No Country for Old Men. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you'll remember. Is there any music in that movie? Because I have a feeling there just isn't.
You know, that's a question for my son.
Yeah, I want to go back and look, but I remember thinking like there isn't a, I guarantee there's no soundtrack for that movie. Like if there's sounds in the background there, but it's just like,
yeah, it's a very still. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. It's a very still movie. And I think that, that's one of the things to me that's so fascinating about the Coen brothers, unlike other filmmakers who can also be excellent. Things evolve. The Coen brothers are so intentional and they have their vision and they're so genius and they bring this vision to life. And so nothing is by chance, or at least as far as I know, mm-hmm. things aren't by chance. They're crafted. And I think they're incredible. So many, I mean, we based our entire marriage on the movie Raising Arizona. And then of course there's Big Lebowski, there's No Country for Old Men. Yeah. Yeah. We basically just speak movie quotes in my household.
I love that. I love that. Okay, so Coen Brothers, and I think almost every film you've named then has been Coen Brothers. Is there any other, like, by the way, just on Coen Brothers, so you know people get like nuck tattoos?
So I
had something in mind that I wanted to get like tattooed on my knuckles until one of their movies came out, because I was like, I can no longer get, and it wasn't at put together like the film title. Do you know the film title I'm talking about?
Because
it's four letter words. So, and it, what they weren't related like to put together as a phrase, but I started thinking about like, so true as in to stay true, like to stay the course,
mm-hmm. uh-huh.
and then grit as in to see it through. And they have a movie called True Grit. And I was like, damn it.
They do.
I cannot tattoo that. I'm so glad I didn't do that now. That would look so stupid.
But also a phenomenal film, both versions of it.
It is.
You know, the original and the remake. Really, really good. Yeah. Non-Coen Brother films, sure. There's many I love. I actually just came back from Telluride and saw Tar, and I saw Women Talking. Both were really, really fascinating films for different reasons. So it's always sort of like, I just consume so many, it's hard to say which I like at the moment.
Those are
two very good.
So do you have some like big directors that are notables?
Yeah, I mean, I will say I huge fan of Dark Knight and Christopher Nolan. I think the Batman and his other work too. I think he's great. I think that I don't know why Darren Aronofsky's in my head because he has a movie out right now. But
wait, what movie? He's one of my favorites.
Are you serious?
Yeah, Pie. Well, so I honestly haven't, so I'll just say like on the list, I haven't even watched Black Swan. I don't know if I watched The Fountain, but like Pie, when Pie, like that movie, like blew my, one of his earliest. And then, what else did he do? He did the
Mother,
Requiem, and then Mother was unbelievable. I love Darren Aronofsky. If he's got something else out,
he does. And I will tell you, it is sweeping Venice and TIFF. It is The Whale with Brendan Fraser, and that is going to be I think, you know, the talk is Brendan Fraser is going to be up for best actor. It is
getting
the buzz. So.
Okay. So I will say, this is crazy. It's called The Whale.
Yes.
So I can't wait to go look this up, but I have always associated Brendan Fraser with not a movie to watch. Like when there's not a movie that I've seen him in that I would want to watch.
You haven't seen them. Well, yeah. So, so he's got an interesting,
maybe Encino Man, maybe Encino Man. Wasn't he in that?
He's had a really interesting journey in Hollywood personally and professionally. And I think I think for those reasons, people are really celebrating him for this as well. And saying he's done a tremendous, tremendous job. One more plug I will have to say. So of course it's another dude, David Fincher, but I will also throw in Chloe Zhao as a director. And then I just recently saw Sarah Polley. So I love seeing that there's more female directors, you know, winning the Academy Awards as well as making more movies out there. So yeah, we could talk about, this is another podcast. First of all, you should charge me money for your therapy session and then do a whole other movie podcast.
I forgot we were even doing this. And now I'm like, oh, I'm going to go find The Whale. I'm very excited. There's an Aronofsky movie out. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for doing this with me. And I will, I'll let you know as soon as we get it together and put up, but appreciate you.
Oh my God, this was great. And I love talking to you. We didn't talk enough about you, but maybe that's next time. And thank you. I really enjoyed it.
One of the top challenges for people seeking employment and education is access to reliable transportation. That's why Well Built Bikes refurbishes donated bicycles and provides them to struggling community members. If you have an old or unused bike that you can donate to their cause, it could provide mobility and independence to someone who can't afford a car or a brand new bike of their own. Visit bikeshoptampa.com to learn more, or swing by the Well Built Bike store in the University Mall on Fowler Avenue.